Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The following program is presented by the Democratic National Committee. The President of the United States ends the first day of his vigorous two-day campaign in New England with another major address in his bid for re-election. Since early morning, when he detrained at Providence, he has motored in triumphant fashion through Rhode Island and Massachusetts, speaking frequently and waving and smiling his acknowledgement of the enthusiastic applause and cheers of hundreds of thousands of citizens. Tonight, Mr. Roosevelt is the guest of the people of Worcester, Massachusetts. He will be introduced by Senator David I. Walz of Massachusetts. Senator Walz.
Mr. President, your triumphant tour through the Commonwealth of Massachusetts today and the enthusiastic welcome at every turn by multitudes must have gladdened your heart. Your presence presented our citizens with an opportunity to which they joyously responded to assure you of the affection and loyalty which they have long cherished toward you. And now, the end of this memorable day brings you to the city of Worcester, the heart of the Commonwealth, its name symbolic of the fountain source of all human affection. Let me assure you, Mr. President, that this city welcomes, greets, and hails you with the special and deep affection its name connotes. We welcome you as the brave and unfaltering leader who has led his people out of the valley of discouragement and despair to the mountaintop of hope, confidence, and security. It would be trespassing on your time and denying this vast audience here present and listening on the radio the opportunity to hear your message without delay for me to attempt the impossible task of expressing in human language the sincerity of our welcome and our deep and abiding faith in your leadership. If Massachusetts' welcome has been somewhat more enthusiastic than elsewhere, and we hope and pray that it has been, as you have triumphantly toured through the country, we hope you will feel that it is due in large part to the realization of the people of Massachusetts that this great industrial state, and its problems and its welfare, your heart and your great intellect has been unceasingly devoted to. Let me assure you, Mr. President, that there is no doubt as to where Massachusetts stands, as in as she did in 1932, she will again emphatically accept your leadership. Mr. President, it is with very special pleasure that I, who have personally witnessed the long and anxious days and months of service and of sacrifice that you have given to your fellow countrymen, that I present you to this magnificent audience. My fellow citizens, I present to you a man who, from first to last, has remained true to the common people. One whose fighting spirit and whose superb accomplishments for the promotion of happiness, security, and prosperity of the American people assured his triumphant re-election on November 3rd. Mr. President, I present to you this magnificent audience who extend to you their loyalty, their affection, and their love.
It's taken only one day of driving through Rhode Island and Massachusetts to prove to me that New England is in step and on November 3rd will be in step with the rest of the nation. I have seen things today even more welcome than your lovely autumn foliage. I have seen the smoke from factories which 3.5 years ago were smokeless. I have heard the sound of mills which were silent. I have seen men at work who are jobless. I have seen women and children who, after long years of fear, have begun to live and hope again. Three and a half years ago, we declared war on the Depression, and you and I know today that that war is being won. But now comes that familiar figure, the well-upholstered hindsight critic. He tells us that our strategy was wrong, that the cost was too great, that something else won the war. That is an argument as old as the remorse of those who had their chance and muffed it. It is as recent as the claims of those who say that they could have done better. You remember the first Battle of the Marne. In the autumn of 1914, almost everybody thought that it was Marshal Joffre had won it. But some refused to agree. And one day a newspaper man appealed to Marshal Joffre and said, "Will you tell me who did win the Battle of the Marne?" "I can't answer that," said Joffre. "But I can tell you that if the Battle of the Marne had been lost, the blame would have been on me." Our war, too, this war that we're finishing, had to be won. No price, we were told then, was too high to pay to win it. We did count the cost. But in the barrage that we laid down against the Depression, we could not stop firing to haggle about the price of every shell. We kept on firing and fighting. And the important thing is that the war is being won. And without that victory, we cannot have the kind of America we know and love and want our children to live in. New England, as one of the senior partners in the Company of the States, has always stood for two of the fundamentals of American liberty. The town meeting, with its essential insistence on local control over local affairs, and the doctrine for which Sam Adams fought with his friends. Sam Adams and his friends, the doctrine of democracy in taxation. And while I do not happen to be a cousin of the distinguished Adams family, I consider myself politically a lineal descendant of old Sam. And in 1776, the fight was for democracy and taxation. In 1936, that is still the fight. Mr. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, "Taxes are the prices we pay for civilized society." One sure way to determine the social conscience of a government is to examine the way taxes are collected and how they are spent. And one sure way to determine the social conscience of an individual is to get his tax reaction. Taxes, after all, are the dues that we pay for the privilege of membership in an organized society. And as society becomes more civilized, government, national and state and local, is called on to assume more obligations to its citizens. The privileges of membership in a civilized society have vastly increased in modern times. But I am afraid we have many who still do not recognize their advantages and want to avoid paying their dues. It is only in the past two generations that most local communities have paved and lighted their streets, put in town sewers, provided town water supplies, organized fire departments, established high schools and public libraries, created parks and playgrounds, undertaken, in short, all kinds of necessary new activities, which, perforce, had to be paid for out of local taxes. And let me at this point note that in this most amazing campaign, I found sections of the nation where Republican leaders were actually whispering the word to the owners of homes and farms that the present federal administration proposed to make a cash levy on local real estate to pay off the national debt. They know, and the people as a whole know, that the federal government does not tax real estate. They know, or ought to know, that it cannot tax real estate. And if they do not know that, I suggest that they read the Constitution of the United States to find out. New obligations to their citizens have also been assumed by the several states and by the federal government, obligations that were unknown a century and a half ago, but were made necessary by new inventions and by a constantly growing social conscience. The easiest way to summarize the reason for this extension of government functions, local and state and federal, is to use the words of Abraham Lincoln. "The legitimate object of government," he said, "is to do for the people what needs to be done, but which they cannot by individual effort do at all or do so well for themselves. And so, my friends, taxes are the price that we all pay collectively to get those things done. To divide fairly among the people the obligation to pay for these benefits has been a major part of our struggle to maintain democracy in America. Ever since 1776, that struggle has been between two forces. On the one hand, there has been a vast majority of citizens who believe that the benefits of democracy should be extended and who are willing to pay their fair share to extend them. And on the other hand, there has been a small but powerful group which has fought the extension of these benefits because it did not want to pay a fair share of their cost. That was the lineup in 1776, and it's the lineup today. And I am confident that once more, in 1936, democracy in taxation will win. Here is my principle, and I think it's yours too. Taxes shall be levied according to ability to pay. That is the only American principle. Before this great war, this war against the Depression, we fought the World War, and it cost us $25 billion in 3 years to win it. We borrowed to fight that war, then as now. In 1917 and 18 and 19, a Democratic administration provided sufficient taxes to pay off the entire war debt within 10 or 15 years. Those taxes in the war days had been levied according to ability to pay, but the succeeding Republican administration did not believe in that principle, and there was a reason. They had political debts to those who sat at their elbows. To pay those political debts, they reduced the taxes of their friends in the higher brackets and left the national debt to be paid by later generations, because they regarded the political debt as more important than the national debt. The Depression of 1929 started in with a $16 billion handicap on us and our children. Now let's keep this little drama straight. The actors are the same, but the act is different. Today, their role calls for stage tears about the next generation. But in the days after the World War, they played a different part. And the moral of the play is clear. They got out from under then. They would get out from under now. If their friends could get back into power, and they could get back into the driver's seat, but neither you nor I think that they are going to get back. But, as in the World War, we have again created a tax structure to yield revenue adequate to pay the cost of this war against the Depression in this generation and not in the next. New more increased taxes are not needed to enable us to balance the federal budget and to begin very soon a rapid reduction in the national debt. Why? Because recovery is with us. Federal revenues are increasing. Emergency expenditures are decreasing. A balanced budget is on the way. Does that sound like bankruptcy to you? Keep on. Why this increase in government revenue? Because the taxpayer earns more money and spends more money. And though he pays more money in taxes, he has more money left for himself and his family. And here are some very simple and very interesting figures. For the average American, we have reduced the individual income tax. Any family head who earns an income of less than $26,000 a year pays a smaller income tax in 1936 than in 1932. Now, that means that less than 1% of the heads of American families are paying today more than they did. And more than 99% of American families are paying less than they did. Because more than 99% of American families earn less than $26,000 a year. And if you want the answer to this talk about high taxes under this administration, there it is. Taxes are higher for less than 1% who can afford to pay high taxes. And they're lower for those who can afford to pay less. That's getting back again to the American principle, taxation according to ability to pay. But you would think, to hear some people talk, that those good people who live at the top of our economic pyramid are being taxed into rags and tatters. But what is the fact? The fact is that they are much further away from the poorhouse than they were in 1932. And you and I know that as a matter of personal observation. A number of my friends who belong in these very high upper brackets have suggested to me on several occasions of late, have suggested more in sorrow than in anger, that if I am reelected president, they will have to move to some other nation because of high taxes here. Now, I will miss them very much. But if they do go, they will soon come back. Because a year or two of paying taxes in almost any other country in the world will make them yearn once more for the good old taxes of the USA. One more word on recent history. I inherited from the previous administration a tax structure which not only imposed an unfair income tax burden on the low-income groups of this country, but it also imposed an unfair burden on the average American by a long list of taxes on purchases and consumption. In other words, what we call hidden taxes. In 1933, when we came into office, 58 cents out of every dollar of federal revenue came from hidden taxes, and leaving out of account the liquor tax, because liquor was illegal when I came into office, leaving out that tax, that's a hidden tax, we have reduced those indirect taxes to 38 cents out of every dollar. How else have we improved and Americanized the tax structure? First, we gave a credit to earned income, that is, income from personal work or service, thus substantially reducing taxes paid by the working citizens. Wasn't that the American thing to do? Secondly, we decreased the tax rates on small corporations. Wasn't that the American thing to do? And third, we increased the taxes paid by individuals in the higher brackets, those with incomes of over $50,000 a year. Wasn't that the American thing to do? Fourth, we increased still further, more steeply, the taxes paid by individuals in the highest brackets of all, men and women with incomes of $1 million a year and up. Wasn't that the American thing to do? Fifth, we increased the tax on very large estates. Wasn't that the American way of doing it? And finally, this year, we had to find new revenue to meet the immediate bonus payment and to take the place of the processing taxes. And this new tax, called the undistributed profits tax, is merely an extension of the individual income tax law and a plugging up of the loopholes in it. Loopholes, incidentally, that could only be used by people with very large income. I want to say a word to you average investors and stockholders who are being flooded by propaganda about this tax. Propaganda, incidentally, that's being paid with your money. It's being disseminated by those who have used corporations in the past to build up their own economic power, who seek by holding back your dividends to keep down your taxes. It is a fact that 98.5% of all American corporations will pay a smaller normal corporation tax under the new law than under the old. And it is a fact that the law permits corporations to expand and build up adequate reserves. But, my friends, for the first time, it gives the stockholder a practical chance to determine for himself whether or not to keep his earnings in the corporation for expansion purposes or to take them out. He is now the one, not the management, not the board of directors. He is now the one to choose between using his dividends for something else or reinvesting them in the stock of the corporation. What we are concerned about, not only people who have no stocks and bonds, but everybody who has ownership of stocks and bonds. What we're concerned about primarily is principle, and the principle of this law is sound. If in its application imperfections are discovered, they must be corrected for the good of American business, just like imperfections in any other statute of the federal government or the state or the locality. I am certain that the average of our citizenship is not taken in by the amazing amount of other tax misinformation which has been turned loose in this political campaign. People tell you that there are 58 taxes on a loaf of bread, or 63 taxes on a lady's coat. But, my friend, stop, look, and listen. You will find what the propagandists do not tell you, that only two or three of all of them are federal taxes imposed by the national government. All the rest are imposed by local, town, county, city, district, and state governments. And remember that two-thirds of all the taxes paid in America are state and local taxes and not federal taxes. And this administration has had something to do with these local taxes. It has made them easier to bear. At the request of local and state governments for whom the local burden had become too heavy, we in Washington assumed the cost of paying in greater part for work for the needy unemployed. And by a national fiscal policy aimed at reducing interest rates throughout the nation, we have greatly lightened the burden of carrying local government debts, helping those of you who own homes or farms or who pay rent. And I want to say a word also to the wage earners who are finding propaganda about the security tax in their pay envelopes. I want to remind them that the new Social Security law was designed for them, for the greater safety of their homes and their families. The fund necessary to provide that security is not collected solely from workers. The employer, too, pays an equal share. And both shares, yours and the employer's, are being held for the sole benefit of the worker himself. I have spoken in Chicago and elsewhere of the simple fact that the overwhelming majority of businessmen are like the rest of us. Most of us, whether we earn wages, run farms, or run businesses, are in one sense businessmen. All they seek and all we seek is fair play based on the greater good of the greater number. Fair play on the part of government in levying taxes on us. And fair play on the part of government in protecting us against abuses. Once more this year, we must choose between democracy in taxation and special privilege in taxation. Are you willing to turn the control of the nation's taxes back to special privilege? I know, and you know, the American answer to that question. Your pay envelope may be loaded with suggestions of fear, and your dividend letter may be filled with propaganda, but the American people will neither be bluffed nor bludgeoned. The seeds of fear cannot bear fruit in the polling booth. Inside the polling booth, every American man and every American woman stands as the equal of every other American man and woman. There they have no superiors. There they have no masters. There they have nobody telling them what to do. Save their own minds. Save their own consciences. There they are sovereign American citizens. And there on November 3rd, they will not fear to exercise that sovereignty. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States in another major address in his campaign for re-election, delivered at the end of a long, strenuous day of campaigning in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. Tonight he spoke to the people of New England and to the entire nation by radio, with his visible audience, an overflow crowd of many thousands, in the Municipal Auditorium at Worcester, Massachusetts. This program was sponsored by the Democratic National Committee and reached you direct from Worcester through the National Broadcasting Company.